open Oregon State Senate's Senate Revenue Committee for what week? Is this spring break week?
Today is the first day of spring, Mr. Chair.
Is it really?
Yeah. That's why we've returned to winter. We've had spring and winter. Now
That's
we have
true.
Winter and spring.
So today is the official, spring equinox?
Yeah.
When do the clocks turn back?
I believe that's another week.
Huh? That's one of my favorite. You know, you get an extra day, I believe, on...
You spring forward and fall back.
Is that correct? No one's nodding.
No, you don't get an extra. You lose it in spring. You gain it back in the fall.
Oh, so you actually... Okay, that's my least favorite day.
You have to be here at 7:30.
That's right.
You're at 8:30.
That's right. You lose an hour. Okay, so where we're at, we are going to begin, and we've kind of held off on this, other than that affordable tax hearing that we had, or affordable housing tax credit, we have stayed away from the world of tax credits and tax exemptions up until this point. But what we're going to do as in this committee is start looking at all the tax credit bills, the tax exemption bills, beginning this week. And we have, I don't know, Paul, probably 20, 30, 40 bills. Maybe, or less.
Yeah.
So we're going to start hearing our tax credit bills.
Thank you.
This week and into early next week, and start sorting through if any of those are going to move. And today is the first day of that, and it deals with some bills that Senator Courtney has brought to our attention. So, without further ado. We will open a public hearing. Which one?
18 and 19.
On Senate Bill 18 and Senate Bill 19. Liz Beth and El Presidente.
Chairman Deckard and committee members. With Senate Bill 18, I'll just kind of briefly give you an overview. It's connecting Oregon law to the federal law exclusion of qualified military benefits under Section 134 of the Internal Revenue Code. And it's going to apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2001. It connects Oregon's law to federal law automatically then in the future to federal law changes of the military death gratuity benefits. It's providing taxpayers with the ability to make refunds of the tax if the refund is based on this inclusion of military benefits. It allows claims for refunds until January 1st of 2006, and it's effective 90 days after the end of the session. And just so everyone's clear, basically under current law, we're not connected with the federal law. And in 2003, there was a Federal Military Family Tax Relief Act, which increased the death benefits for military families, and it doubled it from $6,000 in the death for each family to $12,000, and now it excludes 100% of that death benefit. Now, what this bill, under current law, what we only have is just a $3,000 exclusion on the death benefits given to families. So this act will conform Oregon with federal law, and the exclusion amount will be $12,000. Now, this doesn't have a real big revenue impact. It's a loss in the 2005-2007 biennium of $31,000, and that's just because it does go back to 2001. And then in 2007-2009 biennium, it's $5,000. So it's really only about $5,000 a year. Now, so everyone's clear, too, what we have coming to you that House Revenue has been working on is our big federal reconnect bill, which is House Bill 2542. And this has the provisions of connecting to the Federal Military Family Tax Relief Act in it. So just so you're clear that you do have another vehicle coming to you, hopefully sometime soon, which will be connecting to these provisions in the Federal Military Family Relief Act. So that's basically what Senate Bill 18 does. And then with Senate Bill 19, it's also dealing with military compensation, and it's exempting the military compensation for active duty, Oregon National Guard, military reservists, or organized militia from the personal income tax for all of their active duty pay. So this applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2001, again, same effective date as the other bill. And they have to claim it before January 1st of 2006. It allows refunds of personal income taxes beginning January 1st, 2001 and before January 1st, 2002 if the claims for the refund are based on this inclusion of the military compensation. And then the refunds must be made by July 1st, 2006. This is a larger revenue impact, a loss of $1.7 million in the 05-06 fiscal year due to going back to 2001, and then for the biennium, a loss of $1.9 million. Now, basically, under current law, what we have is that all active military duty that's performed outside of Oregon is excluded from Oregon personal income taxes. But if your active duty military pay is for military duty here within Oregon, then we have a cap on the amount that can be excluded, and that's $3,000. So this act is really eliminating that $3,000 subtraction and allowing a complete exemption then of the military income of active duty military pay.
And this language is not in the Federal Reform Act.
Correct. And Senate Bill 19, it would be something different than what we have in the Federal Reconnect Bill. Because, again, Reconnect is trying not to bring forward any new concepts besides just connecting with federal law. And the federal law is such that you are allowed all your active duty pay, regardless of where it's performed, to be excluded from federal income taxes. It's just states have taken the position that if your active duty pay is outside of the boundaries of your state, then you would be given that exemption. So we can give you a survey of different states if you would like that. I don't have that in front of you today, but I have done
it.
Some of that. Yeah, so we can give that to you.
Questions for Elizabeth? Good morning. Looks like we have a PowerPoint.
Not for us. Chair Duckett, I'm Peter Courtney, State Senate District 11, live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm here today to testify for Senate Bill 1819. Chair Deckard and members of the Senate Revenue Committee, do you give me permission to have seated with me the Commandant, I refer to him as Mike Caldwell of the National Guard, and Learned and High Staff Counsel Chris Garrett, please, or would you ask me if you want me to ask them to please excuse themselves and sit in the seats behind me?
Let me get the nods here.
We can grant that permission, I think.
Okay, I think we're comfortable. Senator Metzger.
I have one question, though. Chris has sat with the President on numerous occasions before committees of which I've sat, and has not yet been allowed to speak.
Oh.
So if he actually says something this time, then I think he should stay up there. Otherwise, I wonder why the President keeps asking him to come up, if it's for moral support or otherwise.
Senator Duckett. Chair Duckett, Senator Metzger, that's correct. He's yet to speak, and that has embarrassed me because I do think that he knows he helped put the testimony together, basically did. So it is support because I get questions I can't answer, and so I would hope that you would direct all your questions to him and not to me when I get through my testimony.
Now, the only other question I have is the PowerPoint, because I haven't seen you walk us through a PowerPoint. And if you could slide that, if it does move, it's not your. Well, I still feel free to slide it on down.
Hit page up and see what's on there.
Yes, sir. That's not my PowerPoint. I don't know the first thing about this PowerPoint.
I don't know what it's doing here. PowerPoint.
I don't know what's doing here or anything else. If you're looking to me to do some of that, I do not know anything about this.
Have you done a PowerPoint before in your life?
Senator Deckard, I was raised in a different generation, and my generation just doesn't do PowerPoints. He says, no, I've never done a PowerPoint. You know what? I'm not going to start today either, Senator Deckard.
Just say no.
That's right. Not you sufficiently embarrass me. I'll quickly talk about Senate Bill 18, although your learned and high staff, Ms. Beth, has also basically given my whole testimony. As you know, it relates to the survivor death benefit for military families. It's interesting, members. For nearly a century, the federal government has paid a death gratuity to families of soldiers who were killed in time of duty. This has never, however, been more than a token. And let me tell you about that. To give you some perspective, Congress doubled the benefit in 2003 to $12,000. Congress also amended federal tax law to provide the death benefit would no longer be taxable. Oregon law, however, continues to tax most of this death gratuity. Only the first $3,000 is tax-free. Basically, this Senate bill would allow a change Oregon law to make it consistent with federal law to exempt the entire federal military benefit from state income tax. This major measure is made retroactive to 2001 tax year in order to provide relief to the families of those Oregonians who have already given their lives in combat since September 11, 2001, including the 10 members of the Oregon National Guard who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. Senate Bill 19 is broader than Senate Bill 18 and would exempt from Oregon income tax the active duty pay earned by National Guard members and reservists who are called to active service but remain stationed in the state of Oregon. As I understand it, it's fairly uncommon for members of the Guard and reservists to be in a situation where they are called to active duty and yet remain stationed in this state. Last year, the military department estimated this legislation would not affect more than a few dozen people at any one time. Senate Bill 19 is a matter of simple equity. It will change Oregon tax law to exempt the income of Oregonians who put their lives and jobs on hold in order to fulfill their active duty obligations and then by sheer luck of the draw are assigned to federal duty in Oregon and therefore pay Oregon taxes while other soldiers from the same unit are assigned to duty across the river, for example, in Washington, and therefore pay no Oregon taxes. This proposal was contained in Senate Bill 231, which passed the Senate near the end of the 2003 session, but did not receive a 4-vote in the House before we signed it. That is my testimony. I did abbreviate it. I believe each of you should have received a more extensive written statement from me on both these pieces of legislation. I do not like to read too much from my testimony. That's why I abbreviated both my comments on Senate Bill 18, Senator Chair Deckard and members of the Senate Revenue Committee, as well as Senate Bill 19.
Questions for Senator Courtney? Yes.
I noticed that you say in your written testimony that you thanking us for allowing you to testify to us this afternoon. We're speeding along here. I submit that we haven't yet gotten to the afternoon portion.
Well, that's a good pickup that no one else on the committee picked up. It's definitely not the afternoon. It's not even close to the afternoon.
Not even in Texas.
No. Nowhere in the country.
Chair Deckard, members, that is a major error on my part, and I apologize profusely to you and to the members of the committee and to Learned and High Staff, Elizabeth.
But West Virginia, it is.
A little close. No, it's not.
12 more minutes.
The one thought I have on Senate Bill 18 is that though the language is included in the Federal Reconnect, and obviously 19 is not, my preference would be if we want to move a bill that you would do a bill outside the Federal Reconnect bill just for the symbolic effort of voting just on this instead of something that is included with about 15 or 20 other different provisions. And I don't know if Colonel Caldwell or Senator Courtney or Mr. Garrett, if y'all have thoughts on that, but that's my gut, is that it'd be better to pass individual bills and let the governor sign individual bills if we had.
I defer to the gentleman on my right as well as the wisdom of the committee on that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell with the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department. I would concur with you, Mr. Chairman, that I think that would be a good effort and show particularly the service members of the state that this body does care about what's going on, and we don't get it bogged down again like we did in the last session, which was hurtful, I think, to a lot of individuals. I would also like to add for the record that I'm not sure exactly where the revenue impact numbers came from, but in essence, even if those were accurate, and I'm not suggesting they're not, but I doubt them, the only way that the state would be benefiting tax-wise would be essentially a windfall, because typically, and the bill is written specifically to prevent any abnormal taking of or paying of taxes when in line 8 it talks about after a change in status from Title 32 to Title 10 for the United States Code. That's significant because while you're in reserve status, you're in Title 32 U.S. Code, which means you're under the control of the governor. In Title 10 status, you're under the control of the president. So in Title 32 status, any income you gain will only get the $3,000 tax exemption that's currently allowed in the state law. But if you go to Title 10 status, which is not a typical status for a guardsman or a reservist, that only happens when you're mobilized. So in essence, the state would get a windfall by virtue of this mobilization if they were to get it. They're not getting it now because their soldiers aren't earning those dollars right now because they're not mobilized. Only when they're mobilized. And so that is the key, I think, to Senate Bill 19, to ensure that the state doesn't get less, they're just not going to get more. And I think that I would focus on that as opposed to the other number. You can make any number you want be an impact, but we don't know how many more mobilizations we're going to have. Mm-hmm. We didn't know these were coming. So I think it's simply truly a windfall to the state of Oregon, and I think that would be the way I would characterize it and look at it if I were you.
Yeah, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Caldwell, that what you just said, I'd like to have you mention that again so I understand it. Are you telling me that the change of status is that under the current, before they're mobilized, you know, receive X amount of dollars as part of their agreement with the National Guard, and then if they're mobilized, that increases under that. So are you saying this bill only affects the difference between what they had received and the new pay after being mobilized under Title 10, or does it then go back and cover the entire income stream, including that base pay that they would have had as before they'd been mobilized? If that sounded to me like you said it's only it's a windfall because they wouldn't have earned that money. But I'm a little confused about that. Maybe Liz would know about that. I mean, does it cover the entire pay now, including what they would have earned from Oregon, or just if it's a windfall, then it would be just that those dollars over and above what they would have normally received as a reservist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, the way the bill is written was written this way specifically to capture those soldiers, reservists, guardsmen, who are mobilized by the president and moved out of Title 32 status. In Title 32 status, that means you're under control of the governor, you're in the state of Oregon. And any money you earn in Title 32 status, whether you're a full-time National Guardsman or you're a traditional National Guardsman or traditional reservist or full-time reservist, falls under the act that you get $3,000 exemption. The way this bill is written, you have to change status. And the way you change status is you go from Title 32 status, control of the governor, to a call-up status, to a mobilization status. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to earn more money in that status because you're going to be working every day and you're going to be paid every day. While you're a traditional guardsman or a reservist, you get 4 days' pay a month and 15 days of annual training. And that typically is around $5,000 to $6,000 annually, you know, for the average guardsman or reservist, somewhere in that neighborhood, some more, some less. But, you know, if you average it out, it's probably around $6,000. That Title 32 money has got a $3,000 exemption associated with it. Title 10 money is going to be taxed, period, if you're in the state of Oregon. For instance, a recruiter, an active duty recruiter, because without going through in 8 and 9 where you change status, you don't qualify. And Title 10 recruiter didn't change status. They're a Title 10 recruiter. They're sent in from the Army. They live in Oregon. If they claim Oregon as a residence, which most of them don't, then they're going to be taxed on the full sum, less than $3,000. Is that clarifying?
Yeah, thank you.
Sir, go ahead, sir.
So, Colonel Carl, if you could work with Lizbeth and Paul, just to ensure, we want to, one of the most important things we do is get our revenue impact statements accurate. And so if you could work with them to true up, because what we'll have to do is we'll look at, we're about 3 weeks out, so you have some time, but we'll have to, as we consider tax credits and exemptions, we'll have to look at the revenue impact that it has. So that information, I think, will be helpful to us.
Mr. Chairman, that very well could have come from the military department. If it did, I apologize, because I didn't catch it when it went out. But
Chairman Deckard and committee members, well, basically with Senate Bill 19, from what I had heard, is that there were certain troops that were being deployed to, like, Umatilla. So they were going to be moving from a Title 32 to a Title 10. So those are the ones that you're trying to capture here. Those people who are on active duty, they've changed their, as far as their assignment, so that they had to be, but they've got assigned to Oregon. They didn't get assigned overseas, and they didn't get assigned to another state. So that's what we're trying to capture here with Senate Bill 19. So,
Mr. Chairman,
as far as the largeness of the revenue impact, you've got almost 5 years in one fiscal year. So going back to 2001, so you've got four full years in there, from 2001 to 05, all within 1 year. So that's why that's so big in that first fiscal year. And we can go back and look at as far as the, you know, sheer number of people that are in that first year, because I don't remember exactly this spreadsheet. But basically, it's you've got a big impact in the first year just because you're going back to 2001. And it's that simple.
Mr. Chairman, your staff is absolutely correct. This bill was designed before, as the good president indicated, was designed for a certain select few number of people. What occurred was 1249th Engineer Battalion, stationed here in Salem, their headquarters in Salem. They have units scattered throughout the Willamette Valley on the north coast and over in Burns, as a matter of fact, it ended in Burns. A unit was mobilized to federal active duty, went from Title 32 status to Title 10. They were scheduled to go to Iraq. They arrived at Fort Lewis. They were preparing to go to be deployed. At the 11th hour, the Army decided they didn't need them there. They said, we've got plenty of engineers there. We don't need you anymore. However, since we've pulled everybody out of Fort Lewis, we do need you at Fort Lewis. And since we've already mobilized you, we're going to keep you on active duty for a year. So the beginning of their first year, they spent the majority of their time, probably the first 6 months, they were at Fort Lewis. About halfway through their one-year deployment, they were divided up in three groups. One group at Fort Lewis, one group went to Yakima Firing Center, and one group went to Umatilla Army Depot to pull guard duty. The group, and it was strictly by luck of the draw, they didn't select anybody by, they said, Company A, you go here, Company B, you go there, Company C, you go there. And the one company ended up in Umatilla Army Depot. Just luck of the draw. Their buddies on the other side of the river, Yakima, didn't get taxed. They did in Yakima, or in Umatilla. So it was a very strange situation. We had never dealt with it. We hadn't thought of it, because typically when you get mobilized, you leave the state of Oregon and you go someplace. I mean, that's been the standard. It's not always the case, but 99% of the time it is the case. And these individuals became taxable with that income, and we thought it was very unfair. We went to the president of the Senate last session, as he indicated in his testimony. It died on the speaker's desk in the House, and it was simply an equity issue with those 1249 folks.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we constructed the bill to try to make it so narrow that you can't expand it. So to my knowledge, the only people we're talking at this point is 1249th Engineer, one company, about 120 people, and these folks earn an average of, on active duty, they're going to earn an average of around $30,000 a year, so you're probably talking 100 people times $27,000
mm-hmm.
taxation, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad you did. We're glad you brought this to us. The spirit of the bill is obviously about this, of the highest calling that of ones that we get here, and it's a tough. This is a tougher one to do a revenue impact. It's all hypothetical when you're looking at a lot of these revenue impact statements.
And again, I'll emphasize that any taxation the state collects would be a windfall.
Mm-hmm. That's new. Yeah. Yeah. Other questions that we have for this panel. Mr. Chris Garrett has not yet testified. It's March 21st, and he has not testified before a committee. Last session, the governor was, it was the first committee, we were the first committee the governor testified before. So I'd like to keep that tradition going. Mr. Garrett, anything to add on this bill or any other bill that we're considering?
Well, Sherrod Deckard and Senator Starr, Chris Garrett from Senator Courtney's office, just wanted to clarify regarding the phrase good afternoon in the testimony. As always, any errors in Senator Courtney's testimony are purely the fault of his staff, not himself.
He's quick to let us know that. I'm surprised in this instance he didn't, but that is, he's usually quick to note that. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. McDonald.
Good morning, Chairman Deckard, members of the committee. My name is Matt McDonald. I represent Oregon veterans, specifically the ex-prisoners of war, disabled American veterans, veterans of foreign wars, military order world wars, the Military Officers Association of America. We respectfully request that you pass this bill on with a due pass. It's a good bill. It's a fair bill to our reservists. And if it didn't go on, it would really be unfair to the 12, to the organization that went to Umatilla. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Well, we appreciate your testimony, and just I guess I'd ask you the question to the folks that you represent. Would it be helpful? We can include this in an omnibus federal reconnect bill, or we could pass at least 18 and 19 individually. And do you think there would be some value in having the state senate and the state house and the governor act individually upon one of these? You get the same result, but you get a better flavor of discussion in honoring those who are serving our country.
Chairman Deckard, there's a lot of bills coming up that are going to affect revenue, and I think we have to prioritize those bills and make a decision in the end of what the state of Oregon can afford. But in this bill, I think it's we don't care how it goes, as long as it passes.
As long as it passes. Great, great. Well said. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 18 or Senate Bill 19? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 19. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 665. We'll come back to this issue. It's also in the Federal Reconnect Bill, and Senator Winters is doing a lot better, but not with us today. So, Lizbeth, do you want to just briefly...
So Chairman Deckard, with Senate Bill 665, this is expanding the definition of qualifying child to include a stepchild of a taxpayer to qualify for the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit. It's applying to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2005, and it takes effect 90 days after the end of the session. So I've also given you the federal code, because basically, as you were just saying, Chairman Deckard, this is in our Reconnect Bill, and what we're doing in the Reconnect Bill, House Bill 2542, is it's broadening the definition of qualifying child for the Working Family Child Care Credit by connecting to this federal definition of qualifying child in Section 152A. So this basically, that's why I gave you a copy of this, so you can just kind of see. It's got quite a broad definition. It can be a son or daughter of a taxpayer, a stepson or stepdaughter of the taxpayer, or a brother, sister, stepbrother, or stepsister of a taxpayer. And it goes on down the list. But and it can be also any individual who, for the taxable year of the taxpayer, has had his principal place of abode, the home of the taxpayer, and is a member of the taxpayer's household. So that can include foster children and others that are dependent. So basically, what Senate Bill 665 is doing is it's just adding stepchildren, but the Reconnect Bill will make that even broader and deal with some grandparent issues, and the Department of Revenue did an audit on the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit in 2003 and found that there were some that were claiming these Working Family Child Care Tax Credits, and they weren't fitting under the definition of child. So that's basically what this is dealing with. And so the revenue impact is not large from doing this, but basically you're just trying to capture some of those situations that aren't captured just by the word child under existing law.
Great, great. Deborah, did you want to... We are going to come back to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Staff has explained this very well, Mr. Chair. I did just want to point out that as we initially started to administer this credit, we had questions. We asked our attorneys, but we now have a rule that includes stepchildren in the definition of child for purposes of this credit. So We currently treat a stepchild as a child for purposes of the credit, so we're doing what the bill would provide. The other...
Do you need a change in statute? Or you feel that the rule gets you everything that a statute would get you?
I think we're pretty confident that stepchildren can be included in the definition. This would spell it out, but the concern that I would have is if the Reconnect bill picks up the definition that's in federal law now and this bill were also adopted, you might ask counsel whether this would actually be more restrictive than what you would otherwise have just through the Reconnect bill, because here you're saying it's a child or a stepchild, and that is specific. So my question would be, are these other categories that Liz Beth talked about picked up through the Reconnect? It may be more restrictive if you pass the Reconnect bill than what you intended to do.
If you could talk to Sean in the Senate Republican office, he's the one that I think has done a lot of the work on this, and I would defer to him in terms of which bill they're most interested in. Senator Winters and himself are the ones that I know have worked the hardest on this.
I will.
Thank you.
Thank
Any
you, Mr. Chair.
Questions on Senate Bill 665? Thank you. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 665, and at the request of Senator Brzezinski, we're going to look at the tax expenditure report. So I'll open. Do I need to open an informational meeting? I do. I'm going to open an informational meeting on the tax expenditure report, and please come up. Senator Brzezinski, do you want to set this up at all, or?
I guess, Chair, all I want to do is kind of get out in the open as to what's currently happening on the tax expenditures. Last count, I know we had over 350 different expenditures that were part of our tax system. I don't think we've really actually had a review of each and every one of those as to whether or not they actually are, I guess, carrying forward whatever the intent was when they first came in. The other thing I guess I wanted to talk about is as we continue to look for or having individuals come before us wanting us to, let's say, create new tax expenditures, what should be our policy? Should we basically be a give and take? If we're going to put one in, should we be taking one out? Mm-hmm. It seems to me we need to do the overview and do an assessment of what we have in place. And then I think the other part of all this is that if we're giving some type of tax breaks in, let's say, in business arenas, should we require some type of follow-through on the part of, you know, a partnership, that if we're going to subsidize or let someone off to help them get their business started, that they are going to be committed to those communities for some period of time, of making sure that the benefit that they're getting actually truly works as a benefit for the taxpayers who are foregoing the tax from those entities that could in fact be providing for schools, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for requesting. And Paul, anything before we hand it over to our panel?
Well, Mr. Chair, this originally requirement came out of the Revenue Committees in 1995, and 96 was the first report, so this is about the fifth report that's come out, and I've asked Craig Fisher and Chris Allenack from Department of Revenue, who have been responsible for putting it together, to come over and walk through that with the committee.
Great. Well, welcome to the committee. I think the most helpful part will be not, obviously, it's a very big book, and we appreciate how easily understandable it is to give us kind of the highlights, and if you don't mind, we might have questions as you go, and we'll just kind of raise an arm to let you know that we have questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Craig Fisher. I'm the research manager at the Department of Revenue, and Chris Allenack is with me today. He's the senior economist at the department, and that's exactly what we'd like to do, is provide you with an overview, some context of the history of the tax expenditure report, as well as provide you with some information that can make this a useful resource for you to understand these particular provisions and the tax system generally. I will provide you with an overview and give you some of that context about the numbers of expenditures and types of expenditures that we have. And then Chris will give you some specific information that relates to the document itself to show you the kinds of information that's contained in the document that will make it useful for you. As Paul mentioned, the requirement of just generally, tax expenditures are a fairly well-known concept. The federal government has produced the tax expenditure report for over 30 years, and roughly half the states produce tax expenditure reports. But essentially, the concept is that a tax expenditure is a provision of tax law that imparts some special treatment to groups of taxpayers. That is, it can be a exclusion of income, an exemption, property tax exemption, an income tax credit. But the term tax expenditure relates to the perspective that these can be viewed as the equivalent of direct spending. It's that you're foregoing revenue that would come in otherwise in absence of this particular provision, but the particular policy purpose for which it's intended can be viewed as the equivalent of direct spending. So that's a general theme of the tax expenditure concept, is that they're provisions of tax law, but they can be viewed as direct spending. Oregon's specific requirement does relate to the Budget Accountability Act that was passed in 1995, and the publication actually has the text of that particular legislation. But essentially, under the Budget Accountability Act, the governor submits to the legislature each session the tax expenditure report. It essentially is a companion document to the recommended budget, so that essentially that linkage with direct expenditures is there, in the sense that the governor presents the proposed budget that represents all of the direct expenditures that for the state, and then the tax expenditure really shows the counterpart to that through the tax system. So, and even the language, the implementing legislation has several direct references to the equivalence of direct spending with these tax provisions. The specific language in the tax expenditure in the Budget Accountability Act, it's any law of the federal government or this state that exempts in whole or in part certain persons, income, goods, services, or property from the impact of established taxes, including but not limited to tax deductions, exclusions, subtractions, exemptions, deferrals, preferential tax rates, and tax credits. I think one of the things that there's a couple of comments I'll make about this definition. First, it's a very comprehensive definition. This is a very broad definition to include a great number of provisions. And because it includes the reference to federal government, Oregon ties to the federal definition of taxable income. So any tax expenditures that relate to that definition of taxable income will flow through to Oregon through that particular tie. But there is the main point of this definition is just, it is quite comprehensive, and as you look into the book, it actually involves over 15 tax programs, although most of those relate to income tax and property taxes, but there are a number of tax programs that fall under this definition. Just to give you a sort of a high-level overview of the types of expenditures that are out there, you can see that there are 352 tax expenditures, and I divided them into three sort of primary components. There are 195, by far the largest number, are in our income tax program. So if you follow across this particular chart, you can see that of the 195 income tax expenditures, the estimated revenue for 05-07 here is about $10.5 billion. Point to that here. That's the amount that we actually expect to receive over 05-07. The total amount of revenue impact from all of the income tax expenditures here is this roughly $8.8 billion. On the property tax side, there are about 120 property tax expenditures. The amount of revenue that we expect in 05-07 is about $8.2 billion, and the amount of revenue impact from tax expenditures here is about $18 billion. I need to point out that this can be a little bit... there are a couple of very large property tax expenditures that really influence that number. In fact, there's an intangible personal property expenditure that accounts for about $10 billion of that $18 billion. The exemption for federal property is about $3 billion of that, and the exemption for state property is about $1 billion. So essentially, those three expenditures alone account for about $14 billion of this $18 billion amount. So those are expenditures under the definition, but sometimes that can be a bit misleading to think of the magnitude of that $18 billion and not be aware that those three very significant expenditures influence that total.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Zanski.
Just to make sure I'm reading the columns, the first column, of course, is just the number of expenditures that we have. The second column is what we actually anticipate to come in the door as revenue, with the third column is what we're foregoing through the expenditure process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prozanski, that's exactly correct.
Thank you.
And then the final category here of these 37 relate to those other 13 tax programs, sort of miscellaneous. Most of the revenue impact from this, I believe, are from the gasoline and weight mile tax provisions, about two-thirds of that provision. So it amounts to about a $35.8 million revenue loss. So that's sort of a high-level view of the kinds of expenditures that are in there, of how the 352 are.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Zanski.
Then on the all tax column, on the very last one, 352, and then the $20.8 billion, and then the $26.8 billion, those would be like, I'm guessing, but like 45% of the potential tax is actually being realized, and the 55% thereabouts is actually going back as expenditures. Guessing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prozanski, that's yes.
Thank you.
To provide a little bit more detail, now I've broken some of these programs. You still have the same general categories, the income tax, the property tax, and other here, but I've split out here some of the individual components with a little bit more detail to show you the composition of the types of things that are included in the expenditure report. So under the income tax, and again, that includes both personal and corporation income tax statutes. Again, these are the same numbers you saw on that earlier slide. But if you break those down, they can be broken into federal exclusions. These are sources of income that are not included in our income tax. This can include employer-provided medical care, public assistance benefits, Social Security benefits, and compensatory damages, the kinds of things that are not included as taxable income. And again, this flows from our tie to the federal definition of taxable income. Again, there are 61 of those, and they relate to about $4.2 billion of revenue impact. There are also, through our tie to the federal definition, there are adjustments and deductions. There are about 48 of those in our tax expenditure report. And these include such items as IRA contributions, deductions for charitable contributions, the mortgage interest deduction, deduction for medical and dental expenses, and Section 179 expensing, where business property can be expensed rather than depreciated. Again, there are 48 of those, amounting to about $2.1 billion of revenue impact. And then the final two components here relate to Oregon-specific provisions. There are 24 Oregon subtractions, representing about $1.3 billion. And those include such things as the federal income tax subtraction, the additional medical deduction for the elderly.
These are ones that are unique to Oregon.
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's correct.
So I think it'd be helpful to get a listing of those 24 that, like, I know the elderly medical deduction is one that we're the only state that has that deduction. It would be good to get a list, and Paul's might be giving what page 11.
Mr. Chair, when Chris provides you with some information, he can show you where to find that specifically in the book.
Right.
And then finally, there are Oregon credits and a couple of other provisions. There are 62 of those, representing about $1.2 billion, and these include the earned income credit, the pollution control credit, political contribution credit, and credit for rural medical practice. Following down this page, you now have property tax exemptions. Again, of the 120 property tax exemptions, some of those are where the property is fully exempt, some there's a partial exemption, and in some cases property has a special assessment. It's treated under statute in a different way. So you can sort of see how the property tax expenditures are distributed among those particular types. And then again, there are 37 of those sort of other programs. Just seen a different way, here's a different way to visualize the income tax expenditures. You can see the first part of this stacked bar really represents the income tax receipts that we expect to receive, again, both individual and corporate, for the 0507. This is the amount of the Oregon credits, the amount of Oregon subtractions, federal deductions, and then federal exclusions. Mr. Chenner, Senator Przanski, I think this is what you were describing in terms of that fraction of the total revenue. Just briefly, I'll touch on the fact that our income tax expenditures represent both individuals and corporations. This is another way to look at those 195 income tax expenditures, only splitting them out in terms of those that affect individuals, those that affect corporations, and then the total effect. And just I'll just highlight, just generally on the individual side, we expect just slightly over $10 billion, about 8.5 of that is represented on the revenue impact for individuals. On the corporation side, expect about $450 million, and the revenue impact of the corporation provisions are about almost $300 million there. Now, again, because there's such a significant linkage of these expenditures to the budget side of things, in fact, we're required to connect these with specific budget programs. This next chart shows, sort of lists the number of expenditures and the revenue impact by program area, and these would correspond to those reflected in the recommended budget. So you can sort of see the relative share of each of those in terms of number as well as revenue. One of the things I'll point out that there are a number of these expenditures that don't lend themselves very directly to this concept of a particular Oregon spending program, and we've classified those in this other category. And this could include what I mentioned, the property tax exemption for federal property. There's basically a federal law that prohibits a state from taxing federal property. So that doesn't translate very easily into that idea of direct spending quite as naturally as some of the credits might. So those are all lumped into this these 98 here that has, again, a very significant revenue impact. This is the place where that intangible personal property component shows up. But this gives you an idea. And if I remove basically that other category just to see graphically kind of how the expenditures in terms of revenue relate to these budget categories, you can see that the human services and economic development are the largest sort of components in terms of those budget categories, with natural resources, transportation, and then a sort of sliver related to education. So generally, that's kind of an overview of the kinds of the kinds of expenditures that Oregon has. And Chris is going to now highlight those items of the report and requirements that can help you use this as a resource, as an information resource.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Alanak with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And I wanted to take a few minutes to go through a little bit of the detail about what information is included in the report and how the report can be used. Mr. Chair, as you commented, it is a pretty thick book. I think it's helpful to understand that, in some sense, it's just a compendium of these 350 provisions, and the information contained on each one of those is the same. So they're, in some sense, the one-page reports for 350 of these elements. So just understanding a little bit of how it's structured can make the report seem not so formidable. First of all, the information that's required in the report, the statute that created the report actually specified a number of items that are required to be in here. And the first of these is the statutory authority that creates the tax expenditure. So for each tax expenditure in the book, we list the ORS number so that somebody can actually go to these statutes themselves and read this, the direct law. And for those elements that are related to or that are due to the Federal Connect, we also include the Internal Revenue Code number. Statute also requires that the purpose for each tax expenditure be recorded in the report. And this is essentially the reason why the tax expenditure exists, either its original purpose or on the grounds which it's defended currently. And on those occasions where the purpose is specifically outlined in statute, that is the purpose that is included in the report. Another item that's required are the revenue loss estimates. And these, we provide revenue loss estimates for the current biennium and the upcoming biennium. So the current report includes estimates for the 2003-05 biennium, which are still estimates at this point, as well as the 2005-2007 biennium. And for those items, as Craig was mentioning on the income tax side, we have just one tax expenditure per item, and we provide a distinct personal income tax revenue loss estimate and a corporate income tax loss estimate. We are also required to categorize all of the tax expenditures according to program or function. And the programs, as you saw in some of the slides that Craig was showing, are the budget programs. That would be education, human resources, natural resources, economic development, that kind of thing. The functions are those the ones that don't fit into that direct spending category. And the functions that we have currently are social policy, federal law, tax administration, and government. The statute also requires that an evaluation be included on each tax expenditure. We currently work with about 30 agencies to provide the evaluations for the individual expenditures. The also required are sunset recommendations for those tax expenditures that are scheduled to sunset in the upcoming biennium. So there is a page in the report that identifies all of those items that are scheduled to sunset next biennium, and it has the statute reference, the revenue loss estimate, as well as the governor's recommendation on whether that sunset should be extended or allowed. Okay, I'd like to turn a little bit to how to use the tax expenditure report. As I mentioned before, it's the book itself can be described as an index, but in the front of the book, there are two indexes. And on page 9, it lists all of the tax expenditures, and this gets at one of your questions earlier, Mr. Chair. All of the tax expenditures are grouped by tax. And each tax in the report constitutes one chapter, so there are 15 chapters, each one covering a specific tax. So, for example, on Table 1, which starts on page 9, the first group of tax expenditures are all of the income tax items. And they are sorted first by type of expenditure. So we have the federal exclusions, the adjustments and deductions, and then the Oregon subtractions are starting on page 11, and that simply lists all of the Oregon subtractions in law. And within this, they are grouped according to program or function, so you can get some sense of some similarity and purpose there. There is also on page 19, there is a different table, and this one is grouped by program or function. So if you wanted to look at all of the tax expenditures, say, related to education, on page 19, all of those tax expenditures are listed there. And they are, again, grouped by tax this time. So, for example, if you wanted to look up some information on, say, the rural medical credit, you can look up in Table 1 under the income tax, under the Oregon credits, and look down the list and find the tax expenditure number for that one, which happens to be 1.139. And if you wanted to read, say, the evaluation on that tax expenditure, you could flip through the book to 1.139 and read all the information that we've provided there. The book also contains, at the beginning of each chapter, about a page or less on the description of the tax. It's helpful to understand, at least in a preliminary fashion, how a tax works before understanding how some of the exemptions to that tax works. It helps provide some context.
Who provides the valuation? I'm looking through here, and it's interesting to read the valuation. Who does departments evaluate the tax credit programs? Or
Yes, Mr. Chair. State agencies that whose mission lines up with the purpose of the tax expenditure.
Oh.
So given the purpose of a tax expenditure, depending on what it's supposed to do, if it's related to education, say, the Department of Education would write that evaluation.
Yeah.
And there are about 30 agencies. And I'll talk a little bit in more detail about the evaluations in a moment. And this other point, the detail for tax expenditure, along with those items that are required by statute, We also include the sunset date for every tax expenditure, if there is one, the year enacted, a brief description. We try to provide about a paragraph or so description for each tax expenditure, and then a who benefits section where we will gather as much information as we can, whether it be from tax returns or property tax roll information on the number of beneficiaries. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about the evaluation process. As Craig mentioned, this is the fifth report, so it's kind of in a maintenance mode, so to speak, and most of the work on the evaluation side occurs for the new and modified expenditures. So at the end of each session, we'll go through and identify those tax expenditures that are either new or have been modified, and each time we go through this, we share all of the expenditures with the agencies. We highlight these for the agencies that we send them to and ask them to provide an evaluation either for the first time or let them know that the law has changed so they may want to modify their evaluation. The information we provide to the agencies will, as I mentioned before, come from either tax returns or property tax roll data or perhaps the LRO's revenue impact statement, whatever information is known about that particular provision to help the agencies write the evaluations. In writing the evaluations, statute provides some guidance as to how the tax expenditures are supposed to be evaluated. And specifically, they are required to be evaluated by answering two questions. First of all, do they achieve the purpose for which they were enacted? That's part of the reason for including the purpose. And then the second question would be, are they the most fiscally effective means of achieving that purpose? So that's essentially what is supposed to be in those evaluations.
Paul, do we have any body? I mean, I'm just thinking the agencies. I'm looking at the ones that I've been involved in enacting. And obviously the agency agreed with me on enacting or usually did. Do we have any independent body that has come in and looked at which ones are effective? And I'm obviously looking at the income tax that are unique to Oregon or semi-unique to Oregon as the ones that are obviously the area of most interest.
Mr. Chair, I think the answer to that is no. We don't have an outside body that comes in and looks at it from a broader perspective. I think there's a lot of interest in that, and I think from members in both the House and Senate have talked about this issue. One of the things I think you tend to get from the agencies is a pretty narrow perspective. And we have our panel comment on that, but it seems to me it's pretty narrow rather than put it in any kind of comparative context. And as Chris pointed out, there is the requirement to look at it from the perspective of this being the most fiscally efficient way to achieve the goal. And that to me would imply a pretty broad examination of it, an evaluation of the expenditure, including could it be used on the budget side or could there be other types of tax-related expenditures that might be more effective. Mm-hmm. And my sense of it is it's pretty narrow in terms of a lot of these evaluations.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, and following up on that, I mean, it really seems on. We kind of touched the general area each session since 97, since the first report actually came back, because I think that really opened the door and eyes for a lot of the members as to how many tax expenditures we actually have on the book. It seems to me that we either need to have a committee that is dedicated to doing this based on a year-round basis, or at least through the interim, to actually take this on and tackle it, because we're going to get a snapshot today, which I really appreciate, and it just fortifies again for me that there isn't that independent review. We are relying on agencies, and who's to say how they're being impacted and affected as to what they're providing back to us. And it just seems to me that since we're the ones that are creating these expenditures, we're the ones that should actually doing some type of overview and oversight, of course, with the assistance of the agencies and those interested parties that are benefiting or maybe not benefiting from it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps what you do is you have, it'd be nice to have someone independent come in and review this book and be able to to come through. I mean, I think what they would provide is a list of, because folks have definitely been through this book, and you get 5 or 10 that are usually the most debatable in terms of their effectiveness. Although I think it'd be interesting to do some sort of sunset on the ones that don't have sunsets on them, because that obviously would call the question right there. You'd have a sunset, right, and the defenders of the program would need to come and make the case. I guess it's two ways of doing it.
That's a good suggestion.
Mr. Chair, I might add that in doing so, it would be helpful if they were prioritized somehow in terms of which ones were independently evaluated. I mean, there are 350 of them, and that is a significant amount to produce an analysis for.
Yeah, well, property taxes are, I mean, those are ones that are going to be less, because we have such a direct, the income tax is one that we have such a direct relationship with. Property is much less direct. So that's your first, I would say, if you're ranking them, that's where you would. So we interrupted you. Do you have a couple more slides or?
Just one other one.
Oh, great.
Just the last point here. This is the governor's book. He's required to submit it with his budget, so the evaluations are reviewed by DAS and the governor's staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just a couple of really quick notes on the revenue is revenue estimates. They are static estimates. They do not include any potential behavioral effects of modifying the tax expenditures. The revenue impacts are produced on an individual basis, so the combined revenue impact of removing two or more of these could result in different combined estimates. The budget impact, this is the revenue loss estimates for the biennium are reflective of current law, and they aren't reflective of modifying that law. For example, the pollution control credit is a credit that can be taken over a number of years. So oftentimes people look at the 0507 numbers, say, and think that if they remove an individual item, they can get that amount of revenue. And that isn't always the case. It depends on the nature of the tax expenditure. I just wanted to point that out. And briefly, on the loss and shift estimates for the property taxes, the loss numbers represent revenue loss to the taxing district. That's due to permanent rate structure. That's value that simply isn't taxed. And the shift estimates are due to higher taxes that are paid by those people who do pay property taxes. And those are the result of largely bonds where the amount of revenue is held constant that needs to be raised, and the rate adjusts depending on how much value is taxed. And lastly, the estimates and the methodology to varying degrees are reviewed by LRO, OEA, and other folks, including state agencies. The last slide, this is just the table, the sunset table from the book. This is also required. This is where the governor provides his recommendation on whether to extend a sunset or allow it.
Do you know offhand what percentage are sunsetted and which ones aren't? What percentage aren't sunsetted? Are just a guess.
That have some not. It's less than half.
Less than half.
Yeah, less than half have some sunset. That would be my quick guess.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yeah.
It would be interesting following up on what you suggested. I mean, if you went through and you set up sunsets on each of the ones that do not have sunsets, and maybe stagger those dates so they wouldn't all come in one biennium, but over a two biennium period. That's one way that you could actually force the discussion, or at least the issue, to come before the body to determine whether or not it's going to continue its existence if we're not able to do something through a interim type of work group, and or, as you suggested, having some independent body perform a review and report back to the legislature at whatever level that might be, revenue or ways and means or whoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll ask Paul to look at what it would look like for us to sunset maybe the income tax credits at a certain year, and then the property at another. Obviously, a great deal of this book are ones that aren't going to be that germane, but perhaps that would just be helpful because you could quickly move through the less than $50,000 and make a decision on whether you even need, or a lot of them have zeros next to them. And so if no one's utilizing the program, do you need to keep it on the books? Other thoughts? I know you guys know this book better than probably anyone in the state. Anything that we should be mindful of as we look at the tax expenditures?
I think your comments, Mr. Chair, I think your comments on having some independent evaluation would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would improve.
Mm-hmm. I mean, partly the Revenue Committee, it's just, I mean, I think the House Revenue looked at this in depth in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not set up well, I mean, because of all the other issues we have to entertain to do a case-by-case analysis of each tax expenditure.
Mr. Chair, the 99 evaluation did result in a number of sunset provisions being added at that point, so it did kind of follow on Senator Przanski's point about the sunsets. But I think in terms of the kind of evaluation process that you're looking at in overall fiscal policy, it's probably more of an interim effort, I think,
mm-hmm.
Because it would take quite a bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, one thing that may be useful that I think agencies may have a difficult time is the setting of some criteria by which to evaluate some of these expenditures would be useful. Because it's fairly open-ended in how, I mean, there's just general guidance about are they most fiscally effective, but that may be useful to provide some direction about what criteria may be used to evaluate effectiveness.
Mm.
So that may be one thing to consider.
Okay, that's good to know. In terms of helping with just the evaluation, I was just looking through the evaluation on the tax credits that I've been a part of, and they said just what I would write, which I believe in them, so I think they're really effective, and they're getting everything we hope they would. Senator Polanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'd like to ask Craig and Chris, I'm not sure if this is the correct terminology, but callbacks where communities that give different tax credits or breaks, usually probably in the property area, require a company that's coming in to actually commit to be in the community for X number of years, and if they fail to do so, then they basically are on the hook, liable for whatever benefit they were receiving. I understand Austin, Texas, I think the state of Colorado may have implemented those type of programs. I wonder if you're familiar with those type of procedures or proceedings.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski, I'm offhand not familiar with them. I'm familiar with the concept, but not any, I haven't looked into it specifically, so I don't have any experience in terms of how they work specifically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something we could look into.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I bring that up because I know that there's a lot of communities that actually had a thing that was on the National Public Radio broadcast probably 3 years back or so, talking about states that were in competition with each other, trying to get Fortune 500 companies to establish themselves in their state, and basically were in bidding wars against other states, trying to give them as many benefits as they could. And it's one of those things that, if I remember the story, it's kind of like at some point some companies will just basically play this for what it's worth, and when the time has passed in getting the tax credit or benefit, they're basically back out there shopping to see what else might be out there to benefit their interest. And it's one of those things that I think it's important for us to do what we can to help foster new businesses and expanding existing businesses, but at the same time it seems like there should be a commitment that if we're going to forego certain taxes that they're going to be community partners and be here for some length of time to get some payout back to the community. And it just seems to me that maybe we should also be looking at whether we should be setting a state policy about how that should work and determining whether or not those type of benefits are going to be extended without some type of, I'm going to call it safeguard, that whatever is foregone is going to actually have a chance to be recouped through a longer period of time of the commitment from those corporations getting those benefits.
We can look at what California and Austin and we're going to be now, just beginning today, tax credits will be part of our diet here of looking at what comes up from the House, what we're looking at, and so we'll have plenty of opportunity to craft and look at different language. So, Paul, if you could grab what California and Austin come up with, it'd be interesting to see it.
I think it might have been Colorado.
Colorado.
Yeah. I'm not sure if California may. But there's a number of cities, and more local have done it, but I think one or two states may have at least broached the subject. I don't think they actually followed through with it to any significant level.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prezanski, to follow up on that a little bit, the concept of the tax expenditure is somewhat independent of whether or not there's a callback, as you referred to it or not. I mean, that the same thing could occur with the direct spending program. If the policy were to provide direct spending to promote a particular activity, so whether or not it's a tax expenditure isn't that callback component of it is, I think, independent whether it's a direct spending program or the portion of the tax system that mm-hmm. allows that incentive.
Okay. Thank you.
Any additional thoughts, questions, comments? Thank you. Appreciate all your work. One suggestion I had on the book is, I don't know if it's possible to put in a bar graph or something. There's a lot of mythology I find around tax credits and tax expenditures on just kind of where the five or six big ones are, how much are individual and how much are business. And so I think it would be helpful to get just at the very front. I get asked a lot of questions just because I work with on this committee, and I find a lot of misinformation might be out there in terms of tax credits and expenditures, and I don't know if there's one or two pages that could be included at the front of the book that say, here's all the ones that you get through the personal exemption, home interest, which are the huge ones that eat up a great portion of the tax expenditures. I think it'd be good to have that out there just kind of up front in a graph form so that people quickly are able to do the math and realize how much of this actually comes right to individuals in ways that we're pretty familiar with.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate the comments. We're trying to make this as useful of a publication as we can, so that will be something we'll look to do.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Jim, do you want to come up and we could bring the lights up. You're welcome to stay there. Jim's a nice guy.
Don't bite. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. Geez, it was. I just want to let the members of the committee know that this was not orchestrated, the little pitch about where the tax credits go, but I have been doing some work, and in order to provide this on a real-time basis, I thought I would. I brought copies just in case. The chairman's question about where do these go, what are the big ones, the mythology about the credits, what's the break between individuals and corporate. I've been doing some work with the same database, the same book at the department. And if you looked at the slides, this is stuff is embedded in what was just presented. I think one bar graph that's helpful, you saw the bar graph of the so-called how much do we actually realize versus how much we don't realize. If you did another bar graph that said how much of all these tax expenditures go to individuals versus how much go to corporate taxpayers, you'd see 97% and a little sliver of 3% at the bottom. And that's right off of page 5. And it was included in these slides. But I've been doing some of this noodling to present that. And your question of where are the big ones, if you look on here, I just pulled off the ones that are over, I think, 100 million individually. So this is just really a random list, but it's the ones I just went through the whole book. This is just income tax, not the property tax. Mm-hmm. Just went through to say where are the real big ones. If you look at Oregon, so these are just illustrative of some of the things that I think if when people say there's $9 billion of money out there that we could realize, well, maybe it's a smaller number since I'm not sure you want to repeal the ones that are on this list here. Most of these, and just a couple points, I think most of the impact, as you saw, comes from connection to the federal code. Most of that comes through benefits to individuals, not to business. I think that's sort of an incontrovertible point. If you narrow it down to the things that you have more direct control over, Oregon tax credits, as opposed to all this federal deductibility and depreciation, all those things, you see on the second page in the top box, $1.24 billion goes to Oregon tax credits. Those are things you have authorized as a body. $1 billion of that alone is the personal exemption credit. I was doing my taxes this weekend. That's on the back page where it says multiply your dependents times 124, whatever the number is. So if you say we're giving away over $1 billion in Oregon tax credits, yes, we are. $1 billion of that is just the personal exemption credit that we allow all families, you know, to take advantage of. If you split just the tax credits alone out between Oregon tax credits that go to individuals versus Oregon tax credits that go to business, you see those numbers there. It's a 95% to 5% split. And I think a point that was made here that may have not been noticed about, if you look at just the Oregon tax credits for corporations, $64 million, the way the book works, the point is, a lot of that is credits that have been authorized in the past that have multiple years. The business energy tax credit's a 5-year work-off. The pollution control tax credit's a 10-year work-off. So if today, tomorrow, this body and the governor signed a bill repealing all Oregon tax credits for corporations, you would not realize the $64 million in the 0507 budget. You'd have a much smaller fraction of that, unless, of course, you could find a way to pass a law to repeal tax credit ex post facto that was already granted and certified. So just, you asked a question, and I've been doing some work, so I thought I'd just jump up and share what I've been doing here. I've been through a number of these reviews, and I think generally people, when the revenue committees have done this examination, certainly there are ones you could pick out of this book and have a public debate about. I'm not at all saying everything in here is absolutely 100% defensible and you can't have a good public policy debate about whether it's outlived its usefulness, etc. But when we've gone through that drill, I think the general thing people have realized is, A, the bulk of this is connection to federal code. We let people do, you know, if you do your own taxes, you do your federal first, you take a number, you transfer it to your state, and then you do a couple of adds and subtracts, but generally we let people rely on federal definition of income. Number two is that obviously, the bulk of what we call tax breaks go to individuals in Oregon, not to business. That can't be argued with. And number three, when we get down to those last remaining ones, time and again, people have come in and made a reasonable arguments when we've done these reviews in sunset process. So anyway, this is just a little project I've been doing since the beginning of the session, and since you threw a softball out there, I thought I'd swing at it while I had the chance. So I appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Well, I appreciate it, too. In some ways, this is helpful. I haven't seen it collected in one form, but in some ways, last session we did, folks were going through when we were down 21% of revenue. We were going through trying to find, and we picked out a couple. I mean, one is unique to Oregon, it's the elderly medical. Mm-hmm. We're the only state in the nation that has this, and we came up with means testing it to help solve Oregon's budget shortfall. The other, which we ended up with a property tax, was on large pleasure watercraft. I think the one thing we achieved is they renamed it, not for large pleasure watercraft, this tax
small
credit.
Watercraft.
Now it's, yeah, the small watercraft. But those were one or two that we found that were ones that bore some examination and action. But
and Mr. Chair, you do recall you also did a across-the-board, what was it, Paul, two or three? You did a across-the-board trim everything by a percentage. That was also in Measure 30. Yes. It was sort of take the big list and trim them all for a couple of years and grab some money that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 20% reduction for 3 years.
Right. 3 years. Which none of which became policy with the state of Oregon. Became policy here, but not with the voters. So, but that was our experience last session. As you took this big book down, you came up with two or three or four that were definitely worthy of consideration.
It seems, Mr. Chair, that if you were to, you know, to claw out substantial revenue out of the tax expenditure report, and the work I've done has just been on the income tax side. I haven't really done this analysis with property tax. It seems to either you would either have to do major dislocation with federal definition of income, and or means testing personal income tax expenditures. You went down that road a teeny little bit last session, but to really get, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars out of this book, it seems like you have to go after means testing individuals or disconnecting individuals and or corporations from major provisions of the federal tax code. I just don't know that there's enough money, at least the way we talk about big amounts of money in this building. There's certainly millions of dollars, if you even on some of these individual ones, but to grab a big hunk of budget balancing money, it seems like that's the route you'd have to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you'd have to be on page one of your list and go to the very top of that list to get the big amounts, even if you means tested them. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Other thoughts or comments? Great, thank you so much. If you do come up with any graphs or illustrations, it'd be interesting for us to take a look at them. Close informational hearing on tax expenditures and adjourn our committee until tomorrow at 8:30.